Jovan Buha! Buha!
Yo, yo! I'm Jovan Buha, NBA reporter and analyst for Buha's Block, and welcome to another episode. On today's show, we are doing part three of our three-part mailbag. We are wrapping it up. Before we get started, it would mean the world to me if you considered hitting that subscribe button on the road to 40,000 subscribers by the end of the offseason. Appreciate you. Without further ado, let's get into it. First question from Nuki LV. After signing Matisse, what would you rank our roster if we had either PJ or Kuminga? Who would be our starting lineup as well? I think the starting part of this is the easy part. I believe the starters would be Walker Kessler, either PJ Washington or Jonathan Kuminga, then Luka Doncic, Austin Reeves, and Quentin Grimes, if we're looking at this from a defensive perspective. So it would be Kessler at the five, Kuminga or Washington at the four or the three, depending on the matchup, Luka at the other forward spot, and then in the backcourt, Austin and Grimes, with Grimes taking the primary assignment. If we look at it from an offensive perspective, it would be Luka at the one, Austin at the two, Grimes at the three, PJ or Kuminga at the four, and Kessler at the five. So that's what I believe the starting group would be if the Lakers end up adding PJ or Kuminga. As for the first part of this question, it's difficult. It's difficult to say with any certainty where the Lakers would rank. What I will say is I believe if the Lakers add PJ Washington, they to me would be the fourth best team in the NBA behind only the Oklahoma City Thunder, San Antonio Spurs, and New York Knicks. With Kuminga, it's a little trickier. I think there's the upside to be the fourth best team in the NBA. I think Kuminga can do most of what PJ Washington can do and can even do some things that PJ Washington can't quite do just with his physical and athletic tools. So there's a higher upside, in my opinion, adding Kuminga compared to Washington. But I think overall, Washington is a proven commodity. He's a more stable and consistent player. And there's already the proof of concept with him next to Luka Doncic. And just with his offensive role, his defensive role, doing more of the little things, I think he knows himself more. He's at that stage of his career where he has bought into what his role is, what the ask is. Whereas Kuminga, I think he's still finding himself. And doesn't mean he can't buy in as a Laker next season or as a Cav or a Timberwolf or wherever he ends up next year. But I still think he's in the process of discovery and the process of testing out his powers. I just saw the Spider-Man movie, so the superhero comparison is fresh on my mind. And like, he's still swinging around the city trying to figure out what he can do and what he can't. Whereas PJ Washington, I think he has a better sense of his strengths and weaknesses. So with PJ, I would have the Lakers fourth in the entire NBA, which I know for some people, including some Laker fans, is probably asinine and just, you know, utterly ridiculous, too high. And I understand, but that's how high I am on Luka and Austin as an offensive foundation. Give them that pick and roll threat in Kessler, give them some shooting, give them guys who can attack closeouts, guys who can keep the blunder going. And then defensively, give them this new army of length and athleticism that they have coming off of the bench. And the Lakers will be, I think, at the top of that next mix after the top three teams, which to me are OKC, San Antonio, and New York in that particular order. But the Lakers, for me, with Washington, they rise to the top of that group. With Kuminga, they're somewhere in like the middle to top of that group. But they do have the upside to be at the top of that group with Kuminga. I just think it's far from a certainty, where with PJ Washington, I have more confidence in what we've seen from him, what we've seen from him next to Luka, and just the asks of that position. I know he's coming off a down year shooting. He's a better shooter than Kuminga, though, for the course of his career. And he also has high leverage reps in that specific role of being more of that off-ball player, standing in the corner, being a catch-and-shoot guy, where Kuminga has been more of a guy with the ball in his hands when he's out there. So I just think that's a key distinction in their games and how they're deployed offensively. And so I think Kuminga has to buy into a certain role. There's a mindset component here. There's like a role acceptance and revival with Kuminga. But then there's also like, can Kuminga even do the job in terms of the shooting, where he's just been a low to mid 30s three-point shooter and catch and shoot guy for most of his career. So I just wonder if he can lock in and be a better off-ball player, be a better shooter And that I just don't have an answer to. So for me, the Kuminga addition doesn't necessarily change where I rank them. It more so gives me confidence in their ability to match up with OKC, San Antonio, and New York, contend with those teams, and then also longer term, having a long-term solution there at the 4/3, depending on the way you want to deploy him defensively. So the Kuminga thing is more about solidifying the starting group and also being able to better compete with the top teams. Whereas I don't know how much it's actually going to change their win total or how much it's actually going to change where I rank them. I'm sure I bumped them up a spot or two, but it's more so about this gives them a better chance against those teams and it gives them a true five-man unit. Whereas right now, I think it's up for interpretation and you could have Mamu, Jake, Matisse, Zaire, etc. And they're all imperfect options. And of course, every option is imperfect. PJ has his flaws. Kuminga has their flaws. But those guys, I think at least on paper, are starting level wing/forwards. Everyone else we're talking about projects more as a bench player. I think Mamu could start if you had like the Thunder perimeter defense or the Spurs perimeter defense. You could probably start Mamu at the 4. Lakers don't have that. So I think they do need to find this position ultimately, whether it's now or at some point during the season. And for me, PJ is the answer, but if not, Kuminga probably checks the box. Next question from No Mercy Teddy Bear. Is it at all possible to land another playable center like Gafford and a good 3-and-D wing like PJ/Kuminga? I feel like Looney is the opposite of what we need, and we really have no non-rookie/sophomore good defensive wings. I have a feeling if we don't somehow upgrade here, the playoffs will be short again. To be fair to No Mercy Teddy Bear, I believe this was sent in before the Lakers signed Matisse Thybulle, so I don't know if that changes his outlook at all, but I just wanted to note that on his behalf that this was submitted before then. In terms of adding both a playable center and a good 3-and-D wing, the first trade package that comes to mind is the Milwaukee trade package. Now we can debate whether Jericho Sibbs is a playable big in a playoff context, and we can debate whether Kyle Kuzma is a good 3-and-D option. I would argue he's probably not, as more of a bench player at this stage of his career. Another option could be Carlo Matkovic and Herb Jones or Sadiq Bey in New Orleans. I think that's an option that would be probably more appealing to me. I think Matkovic versus Sims, we could debate which one's the better player, which one's the better fit with the Lakers. But I mean, certainly you guys know how I feel about Herb Jones. I would take Herb Jones in a heartbeat and take him over Kyle Kuzma. And then Sadiq Bey, I would also take over Kyle Kuzma, though he's someone that similarly I view in a more of a bench role. I don't really view Sadiq as a starting level guy. I mean, I guess he could start in a pinch, and he is on a $6.6 million expiring. So the money's more manageable, especially if you did something like Matkovic and Bay. You can send out something like DK and Hardy or whatever with some draft capital to get those guys. So those are a couple of options. If we're looking specifically at like Gafford and PJ, it is feasible. My hesitation with adding Gafford and PJ specifically, like adding both of those guys, is just the cost. And while you look around the West and you have Jokic is on the max, Wemby took a slight discount, but basically on the max, you have Chet on his max, and Hartenstein's making 25 plus. There's a ton of money invested at the 5 spot in the West. I just think with how much the Lakers are going to be paying Luka, Austin, and Walker Kessler for the foreseeable future, if you already have Quentin Grimes, you already have Mamu, like at some point you could only spend so much on your supporting cast and with your cap sheet. And the Lakers are hard capped at the first apron, so that's a real consideration here. So I would love, like, don't get me wrong, I love Daniel Gafford. I would love Daniel Gafford as the backup 5 on this team. I would feel a much better about the Lakers' backup center situation if it was not Kevon Looney and Mamu as the 2 primary guys right now. Gafford would be a huge step up in like the specific backup center spot, in my opinion. That's not even to say he's a better player than Mamu, but I think he fits the role of what the Lakers need. There's the proof of concept with Luka, and just him as a screener, rim runner, him as a rim protector, rebounder, etc. Like, he just checks that box. But it's just, he's making so much money that it's difficult to justify. You're going to pay like your 3 top guys then you're also going to pay PJ or Kuminga X amount. Then you're also going to pay Quentin Grimes. Then you're going to pay Mamu. Then you're going to pay Gafford. That's basically going to be like seven guys making 15 plus million or you know, roughly in that range. That's difficult to fit on your cap sheet. That's before we even mention Colin Sexton and him potentially opting out next summer, or Cameron Carr or Adu Thiro popping and those guys getting paid a certain amount once their rookie scale contracts are up. So it'd be a great problem to have, don't get me wrong. I just think realistically, with how much the Lakers already invested in Walker Kessler and going all in on him, there is an element of like, why not go further and go get that really good backup big? But I also view it as there are other holes on the roster that the Lakers need to address, namely that starting wing / forward spot. In summation, I agree with you. I would love a better backup five, and I would love that new starting wing / forward. I think clearly the wing / forward is more of the priority for the Lakers, or should be, at least in my opinion. I would prioritize that over backup five because I believe, I mean, this brings us back to the Colin Sexton argument I've been making this whole time is like, I think you need to start building out your roster top down. And I think a starting spot is more important than a bench spot. So once you build out the starting group, then I start thinking about the bench and the depth. But I like having a five-man group, a five-man unit that you're confident in that it, you know, can grow together. Whereas even if it's in the short term, which I think for now, as things project, the Lakers are going to have a short term because Matisse and Zaire are on one-year deals. Jake LaRavia is an expiring. Mamu, I guess, would be the exception, but I have my reservations about Mamu as a starter with this particular group. So it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate this and what they end up doing ultimately with the center spot and the wing spot. But I'm with you that I don't think Looney's an every night option. I think he's more of a 14th, 15th man. More of a situational guy. Maybe Kessler's injured or the backup's injured, whatever. I don't think Looney's a guy you want to rely on every single night, but we'll see what the Lakers do here over the next few weeks or even you know a couple months going into training camp. They need a new starting 3/4 and they need a better backup 5. Next one from one Sid the Kid. Is it crazy to imagine this roster actually fine? No one knew who DJJ was before he played with Luka. Zaire or Adu is that guy? No. It's not crazy to imagine this roster is actually fine. I mean, I would say that I think there's clearly a hole as currently constructed, but the season is not played on paper. And to your point, whether it's Zaire, whether it's Matisse, whether it's Adu, whether it's Cameron Carr, whether it's Jake, whether it's Mamu, I think those are the six realistic options to be that fifth starter. And who knows, maybe they go with a couple of those guys and Quentin Grimes comes off the bench. One of those guys could pop and emerge as the best candidate for the job, at least on the roster. There's a world in which the roster is fine. I want to say that, in my opinion, that's wishful thinking. That's like purple and gold optimism. That's not necessarily based in reality. Like, I just think objectively looking at the roster, looking at what every player has done up to this point in their career, they only have three guys that are clear-cut, no-brainer starters. You can put in Quentin Grimes, you could put in Mamu, but those guys were not even starting on worse teams than the Lakers have aspirations to you know be better than, right? Like Quentin Grimes is a bench guy on a Philly team. They made the second round, but that was a you know lower-seeded East team. Similar, Toronto was battling for home court, you know, pushed Cleveland to 7 in round one. But Mamu also played off the floor in that series. So like, just look at some of the other options, Mamu, Grimes, Sexton, like these guys are all bench guys. And that doesn't mean they can't grow into being starters, but you are kind of wish casting that. And so I think the roster makes sense. I think it's a lot of complementary pieces and complementary pieces specifically around Luka, Austin, and Kessler. They're just going to need a couple guys to make leaps into being clear starters. And I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just like that's more of a hope than a certainty than a guarantee, right? One thing I would say with DJJ, I you know, I know this narrative has been out there a bit. I think it's a little disrespectful and false to DJJ. Like DJJ was a part of that Miami team that made the finals in the bubble in 2020. Wasn't a big part of it. Played 15 games in the playoffs, averaged 6.5 minutes a game. But coming off that playoff run, he signed a 2-year, $19 million deal with Portland. And so DJJ, I'm not saying he was a household name, but he had already made a decent amount, like coming out of the mud with Phoenix and then Miami. He goes to Portland for a year, then ends up getting traded to the Bulls, and then is in Chicago for a couple of years, then makes his way to Dallas. So certainly being on that Dallas team and making the finals for the second time did elevate his profile to a different degree. And you can see coming off of that second year of his contract, because remember, it's 2 years, $19 million, he went back to being a minimum level player. And then after the Dallas season, bounced up to his current deal with the Clippers. But I would say that that's DJJ, the stage he was at with Dallas, he had already been given a notable pay raise and had been in the league for several years. And so I think DJJ was more well-known and well-established than Zaire or Adu. I'm not saying he was a starter. I'm not saying he was a household name. I'm just stating that like he had been proven as a rotation guy who team, at least the market was willing to pay a certain amount of money. Like a 2 year, $19 million back in 2020 is probably closer to 2 year, $25, $26 million nowadays. So he was making about $9 million, a little over nine per year. Adu and Zaire are combining to make a little over five right now. So he was making almost double of what they're both making this season. And that was back in 2020. So I do want to say that I think there has been this notion with DJJ that he was this nobody that came out of nowhere in Dallas. And like, I think Dallas rehabbed his value and rehabbed his image and got him this contract that he just got and sort of put him on a different pedestal. But he wasn't like he was a guy. I mean, there were certainly some flaws with the shooting and the offensive game and whatnot. And I think the best version of him was him in Dallas, to be clear. I'm just stating that I think some of the revisionist history with DJJ and his Dallas situation, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. But certainly Zaire or Adu could be that guy. I think between the two, Adu is actually more like DJJ than Zaire. I think there's a motor component and a rebounding component that's just at a different level with DJJ and his cutting, roaming the baseline, the offensive rebounding, the defensive rebounding, the defense and energy. Like I think that's closer to Adu than it is Zaire, though you could argue, I guess, like from a frame perspective, they both have the slender, lanky, athletic frame. And there are some similarities there between those two, but there's a chance, certainly, that one of those guys pops and that the Lakers are fine as is. Like, I guess it also depends like how you view fine. Is fine 50 plus wins and like a second round exit? Is fine winning a championship? Like, where's your bar for fine? Because I do think this team is going to be 50 plus wins, home court advantage team, and you'll probably lose in round two to San Antonio or OKC. So is that fine? Or you know, because I would agree that like one of those guys can fill that role to some extent. And there is some untapped potential with the Adu and Cameron Carr, et cetera. I just think to be fair to DJJ, he was at a different phase of his career going into Dallas, but had proven himself to some extent. Next one from Lenny Hendo. Jovan, playing devil's advocate regarding Mamu as a starter. There was a version of Rui that could have worked long-term had he reached that Aaron Gordon archetype we were all hoping for. Do the stats support that Mamu could be a closer fit to that? Yes and no. To be clear, Rui and Mamu are not close to Aaron Gordon as a player, especially going back to like late 2010s, early 2020s Aaron Gordon, 2023 Aaron Gordon, that was part of that Denver team. Massive gap, in my opinion, between Aaron Gordon and those two guys. I think Aaron Gordon in his heyday was a top 40, top 35 guy, was one of the best and most versatile defenders in the league. Just this mammoth, powerful, athletic player who could dunk on your head. Clearly, the pedigree with the dunk contest and just one of the best dunkers of his generation. But he found a way to channel his athletic gifts and physical tools into being the ultimate Swiss Army knife, the ultimate number three guy, and filled the gaps and the holes within Denver's scheme and system on both sides of the ball. Like Aaron Gordon is, I think, a unique player who that is like its own archetype. And we've seen guys like OG Anunoby has maybe come the closest recently to being that Aaron Gordon type. Derek White is kind of like that in guard form. Drew Holiday is another one. There are these, the archetypes of the guys who can be that number three or number four offensively, can be your number one or number two defensively, and just make all these winning plays at the highest level. I think Aaron Gordon is the epitome of that in that power forward, big wing role. So to be clear from the jump, I don't think Rui or Mamu is that type of player. So I would say Mamu is closer to it in the sense of, I think Mamu is a better overall or all around player than Rui. Mamu can do more things at a proficient level than Rui can. So for example, Mamu's a better rebounder. Mamu's a better passer. Mamu is a better rim protector. Mamu is a better ball handler and you know, better at attacking closeouts and gaps in the defense. I would say overall, Mamu is a higher IQ player, better processor on both sides of the ball. So from that perspective, he is closer to Aaron Gordon, I guess, in like checking more like versatile Swiss Army knife boxes. The defense though, like I just think there's a fundamental difference between Mamu and Rui in the sense of Mamu is a better defensive rebounder. He's a better helper and he's a better rim protector. But Rui is more mobile and more switchable in a switching scheme. So that's where like Rui to me, his best position is the four defensively, but he can scale down and guard some threes. Mamu, his position is probably best at the four, but he can more scale up and guard some fives. There's not as much mobility and versatility there to scale down and guard threes. So I almost view it as, I kind of feel like most guys have like their primary position and their secondary position. Mamu is a power forward slash center. Rui is a power forward slash small forward. And in both instances, the best way to optimize them is playing them at the four. But Mamu, you can get away with some reps at the five. Rui, you can get away with, and that's the primary way Mamu's been used. But Rui, you can get away with some reps at the three, but you got to be careful. And I still think he's best at the four. So in terms of defensive versatility, I would actually argue, in my opinion, I think Rui is, if you're just saying who could guard three through five better, I actually think it's Rui. Through a certain lens, you could argue that Mamu is a better starting four for this group than Rui is. What I would say is that Rui, I think, is better equipped to guard threes and fours than Mamu is, where Mamu's more fours and fives. And I think that distinction matters when you need that wing stopper, which Rui is not a wing stopper, but he was better equipped to handle those matchups than Mamu was. So if we're specifically comparing them, I think Mamu checks more of the box offensively. Rui checks more of the box defensively. Neither one of them checks the Aaron Gordon box on either end. But if we're making that comparison, that's how I view it. Next one from Tom Cruz. In the fifth man finder tool on B-Ball Index, if we have a core of Luka, Reeves, Kessler, and Grimes, optimizing for defense, it's Thybul. Optimizing for rebounding, it's Vando. Washington ticks both boxes plus decent level of shooting. I feel that at max, we should trade Hardy plus second round pick for Kuminga in a take it or leave it $12.25 million deal. Otherwise, backup plan could be 3 seconds plus expiring at the deadline to get Washington as the trade becomes more palatable for the Mavericks due to the expiring nature of the contracts. We should in no way trade Jake. If he hits, say, 35 to 38% of his threes this year, we will have some sort of bird rights. A young wing cannot let 1 year of shooting disappointment affect long-term roster building. Lastly, we need to give out some scam contracts like a four-year, $10 million deal with team options to Magnon and Kaluma, etc. If they pop, it's much needed as roster will only get more expensive. In your opinion, Jovan, does that make sense? Love your content. Thanks for the B-ball insights. I appreciate that. That was a thorough question. So let's dive into it. In terms of optimizing for defense, Thybul being the best guy, that checks out to me. I think he's the Lakers' best perimeter defender, just straight up. In terms of optimizing for rebounding, Vando being the best guy, that also makes sense. I think it would be between Vando and Mamu, but Vando is a better rebounder than Mamu. And that's where I like Washington. To me, Washington is the best blend of both of those things, where he's not as good as Thybul as a defender, and he's not as good as Vando as a rebounder, but he is good enough and you're good to a degree on, you know, in both regards, and does bring the offensive fit next to Luka. So I agree there. I mean, that's why I like Washington. And I think this speaks to the larger argument of, if it's Mamu it's not optimizing the defense, and it's maybe optimizing the rebounding in the offense. So there's like a pick your poison or whack-a-mole nature here. Vando is not optimizing the offense. He is optimizing or close to optimizing the defense and clearly the rebounding. Thibault is not optimizing the offense or the rebounding, but he is optimizing the defense. Jake is a blend, I guess, of all three. You could argue not optimizing the offense, but does get close to defense and rebounding. Similar with the Dew, Cameron Carr, it's the offense, but not the rebounding or the defense. Zaire, it's the defense and arguably the offense, depending on how he shoots, but definitely not the rebounding. So you look at, if you just break it down to those three general buckets of the Lakers need offense, defense, and rebounding from that fifth starter spot, none of the guys that we're talking about check all three boxes. None of them check offense and defense. And I think you want those two in particular, and really all three. And that's where you get to Washington or Kuminga, in theory. In terms of the Kuminga trade, I'd be willing to offer more in terms of draft capital. I think I would do, at this point, up to 2 second-round picks. And then I would go upwards of $15 million for Kuminga. I would not go above that. So the max I would do is 3 years, $45 million. Roughly, I guess with raises, maybe that ends up being 3 years, 48, 3 years, 49, something like that. But starting out, roughly $15 million AAV. Then waiting to try and get PJ at the deadline. I'm cool with that. If the Lakers cannot get him now, if it is going to be at the deadline, that's just what it is. I think there's other guys they could try to explore and pursue, but if they can't get someone on the Washington Kuminga level, then wait it out. I'm with you with Jake. I think I'm higher than consensus on Jake. Some people were minds blown when I had him penciled in as the starter. I still think he is arguably the best starting option. And I think people like the shooting, I understand it. His mistakes were allowed, right? Jake missing wide open threes, Jake dribbling into a crowd, dribbling the ball off of his foot, Jake botching a layup. He's one of those guys where the mistakes are really loud and people do not forget that. And it bothers fans. It drives them crazy. I totally understand that. But overall, the defense, the rebounding, the connectivity offensively, there were some shooting highs, though at times they were few and far between. And the ability to drive and play some bully ball against small guards when they're put on him. I just think there's a versatility to his game that several of these other guys don't have. They can't do as many things at a certain level as Jake can, even if they can maybe shoot better or overall defend better. Jake just checks a bunch of boxes at a certain level that I think is important. So I'm not saying he's a keeper. I'm not saying the Lakers need to start him. I'm more so saying I think he does deserve a second chance here and to see if he can shoot better and more consistently. Because if Jake gave you what he gave you last year, but he shot 38% instead of 32% or 30, whatever it was, that to me is a massive swing in terms of his overall production and value and impact. So I'm with you there. And for the final thing, I would love to give Mignon or Kaluma a contract. It's just the Lakers are in a bind right now. I think they're going to try to dub some guys, but we'll see what that looks like in a potential trade for Kuminga or Washington or whatnot. And at a minimum, they have to either dump someone or waive them. But I think the thing right now is they want the starter, then they want the backup five, and then potentially Kaluma or Mignon getting one of these longer term team-friendly contracts. So this is lower on the priority list. But if they can pull it off, if there's a way to clear out some of the back end of the roster and you walk out with a new starting 4/3, a new backup big, and Mignon or Kaluma on the roster, I would love that. Next one from Unflushable. Hi, Jovan. What do you think of Grant Williams as an underlooked option for LA? The advanced stats say he profiles somewhat as a best of both worlds of Kuminga and PJ Washington, except he also has the most consistent three-point shot of the three. He's on an expiring $14 million deal, so he has more optionality for Rob than PJ and doesn't have the agent posturing headaches of Kuminga. Charlotte acquired two power forwards this offseason with Naz Reid starting and them likely wanting some playing time for their lottery pick, Steinbach. I can see Grant Williams becoming more available than people think. The whole rescinded trade thing is overblown, in my opinion. A package could be Hardy Connect and Draft Comp, with Hardy and Connect being absorbed into two 2025 traded player exceptions. The Hornets have Charlotte would refresh and consolidate those traded player exceptions into one $14 million TPE and mitigate their roster crunch by a net one player. The Lakers solve their own roster crunch and still preserve the ability to use the non-taxpayer mid-level exception next offseason to potentially use on a quality backup big like Goga or Jalen Smith. What is your opinion on another former Celtic in the purple and gold? Another fun question, another in-depth one. Let's go point by point here. I like Grant Williams. In the spirit of this question, I went back and pored over his numbers and watched some film on him, watched a few games worth of film on him. And what I would say with Grant is I like Grant. And remember, Grant was brought into Dallas to work with Luka, and that didn't exactly go over great. He was traded along with a first round pick for PJ Washington. So Dallas got the better end of that. And I would agree with that. I would say that to me, just looking at the numbers and watching the film on him, Grant Williams just profiles more as a bench level player than a starter. I think he can be a productive and solid bench player, but I don't think he's a starting level player, especially through the lens of like competing with the league's best teams. And I think like the numbers are the numbers, and he actually, I think is a 94th percentile defensive estimated plus minus, which is an awesome number. One of the best all-in-one defensive metrics, and he rates out elite on that end. You look at the numbers, the rim protection is really impressive for a guy of his size, about 6'7", 6'8". And the post defense is really impressive. Some of the screening mobility defensively is impressive. He's got some really impressive defensive numbers. I think the big thing for me is that, similar to the conversation I was just having about Mamu versus Rui, I do view this version of Grant Williams, as he's aged a little bit, as more of a 4-5 than a 4-3. I think he's got the mobility and versatility to guard threes, unlike a Mamu. But to me, like, Charlotte has used him a lot as a small ball five, and I think that's where he's more transitioned. And so, like, to me, he's more of a 4/5, whereas I think the Lakers need either a 4/3 or a 3/4. So there's like a talent overall, just productivity component here, where I don't think he's as talented or productive as Kuminga or Washington. There's a positional fit where those guys, I think, are just more wing-like than him, and have overall better mobility and foot speed and quickness on the perimeter than he does on both sides. And then, you know, to your point about the contract, like, the contract to me would be the most appealing thing. And I guess there's a version of this where if Kuminga goes elsewhere or the Lakers just can't find common ground with him, if PJ Washington isn't available or the Lakers aren't interested in taking on his contract, Grant Williams could be an interesting alternative. Like, I'll say this, I'd probably rather take him than Kyle Kuzma. If, you know, all things being equal, I think he's a better defender than Kuzma and has morphed into, like, his role primarily is just spot up catch and shoot guy. You know, occasionally take a pump fake, take a sidestep three, occasionally we'll rack a closeout and then do like a head fake and take like a step back, or you'll go into like a post up or something. Solid offensive rebounder, particularly for his size/position, but there's not much there offensively there. There is a lot defensively, but I view him more as a guy you want on fours and even switching up onto fives rather than switching onto threes. And I think if you look at his defensive matchups, that aligns more, where he's often guarding centers or he's guarding the lesser offensive threat in the front court. He's not guarding like the primary wing guys. There are some exceptions. He did guard Tatum and Brown a bunch in the regular season, so that would be a pushback to this. But if you look at his overall matchup data in terms of who he's guarding, it is tending to be, at least like in terms of specific players, it's tending to be centers and it's tending to be some of the lesser offensive threats. Whereas I think the Lakers would need a guy who's just a little bit quicker. I just view Grant as a solid bench player, but not a starter. In terms of the trade package, it's interesting. And the Hornets maintaining a traded player exception makes some sense on their side. So depending on what the draft compensation is, for me, I would only give a second round pick. I would not give more than a second round pick for Grant, but Because I think there's an element here of I would view this as a short-term solution. I would not view him as the long-term starter. So maybe he could be a long-term bench piece, but you also have some investment in that position with guys like Mamu and Adu and potentially Zaire and Jake, depending on what happens with those guys and how they fit this year. So that would be my hesitation with that, or just why I view it as more of a short-term solution. And then one thing though, in terms of the non-taxpayer MLE, this is a minor gripe here, but I would push back and say Goga and Jalen Smith are not non-taxpayer MLE guys in terms of the full thing. And I think the Lakers are going to be looking to use that on a wing, not a backup. I think they do need a backup, but I would take Goga or Jalen Smith, although Goga, we'll see how Luka feels about that now after their interaction earlier this past season. But I don't think those guys are guys that the Lakers would use the non-taxpayer MLE on, to be clear here. I think the Lakers clearly need another wing level starter / high bench level type guy. And that's a Derek Jones or Lu Dort, Max Strus, someone in that general range of being added to the roster in addition to the Washington or Kuminga. So I would just minor thing, but I would just note that I don't see them using that tool on a big man. I think they're going to use it on a wing. And in terms of another Celtic in the purple and gold, we've seen Rick Fox, Rajon Rondo, Avery Bradley, it happens. But Grant Williams is not someone who I guess if you think back on his career, I view him most as a Celtic, but he didn't win the championship as a Celtic. I don't know. It's just a different level than like when Rondo did it, right? With all the battles that they had in 2008 and 2010, he's not played the Lakers in a finals. So it's fine. I would take him. I don't think he's a long-term solution. He would be a lower priority for me. And I don't think I'd give up more than a second round pick. Next one from Dalboys805. What do you think the over-under will be for organized offense? With all the other contracts we can trade, would you rather have a player on the roster or have a trade exception in your back pocket? I'll answer the second part first. I would rather have a player under contract in terms of like if you can add a starting level player or a true solid backup five, I would take that player. If it's shuffling in or you're shuffling out Dalton Connect and Jaden Hardy for other minimum level or lower level players, at that point, maybe I would take the trade exception over the player, but I would probably rank it as adding like real talent and playable guys first, trade exception second, and then you could dump a couple guys and then you create a trade exception and then also just sign Mignon or Kaluma or something like that. So that would be, I guess, my preference here. In terms of organized offense, last year per Krangis, it dropped from 54% in JJ's first year to just 53% this past year. So I would put the offensive organization rate over under at like, I'll go 54.5. So I'll bump it by, or I'll put the line 1.5% higher than this past year. And 55%, I think, is generally the minimum good range, if I'm not mistaken. And I think you want as close to 60% or roughly 60% as possible. So I'll say 54.5 and I'll take the over. I think this is not only a team built in the likeness of Luka Doncic, but also a team built in the likeness and vision of JJ Redick. And so I do expect JJ to have a stronger finger on the pulse with the offense, this offense to finally click in a way that we have not seen it click yet, for it to hit that top five offense, if not potentially top three offense level, and for the offensive organization rate to bump up to, putting me on the spot, I will say 56% this year. So I'll say, it bumps up 3%, which is a notable percentage increase. I will go with 56%. And next time I have Krangis on, I will ask him about this and his interpretation of what LA's offensive organization rate should be. And if my 56% mark is in line with the additions and his vision for all of it. Next one from Miko. Assuming no Kuminga / PJ deals, how would you project Williams' minutes in game? With Jake starting, is he more 20-ish or 15 or less? Or maybe JJ goes for a do with lack of defense. It's a great question, and it's a question that I will admit I have no idea right now what the rotation is going to look like. I'm hoping to do another depth chart / rotation projection this week following the Matisse Thybulle addition. I was hoping the Lakers would have this starting forward / backup big situation resolved, and maybe they will resolve it this week. But for I do want to dive in and look at what I think the projection will be. To your point about if Jake is starting or not, I think that's a huge swing factor here, because if Jake is starting, even if he's just a placeholder starter, that's going to be 18, 20 minutes. You rarely see guys start and play fewer minutes than that. So if we just pencil in Jake at 20 minutes and let's put Kessler at like 30, 32, that leaves 28 backup minutes at the four. And let's just say 16 backup minutes at the five for some combination of Mamu, Looney, Vando, Adu, Zaire, potentially Luka in certain configurations where he's more of the four. There's not a lot of time left. That's 44 minutes for all those players. So I think Jake starting is a huge potential swing factor, where Mamu starting, for example, like Mamu, I'm already penciling in as at minimum 20, 22 minutes off the bench. If he starts, that probably bumps up. So Mamu, like if Zaire doesn't start, of course his role in minutes will be impacted. But I think there's a difference between a guy like Mamu starting, who is going to be in the rotation no matter what, versus Jake, who if he's coming off the bench, there's a chance that he just gets buried behind Zaire, Matisse, Adu, Cameron Carr, etc. So that's its own swing factor here. If I'll give you two versions. If Jake is starting, let's just say he's playing the 20 minutes, I do view Zaire as more of that like 15, 16 minutes a night. If Jake isn't starting and it's someone, it is Zaire, then Zaire I could see being in like the low 20s. If it's Mamu, then I'll give you three versions. If it's Mamu, then I think Zaire's probably safe and he's somewhere in that mid to high teens. So right now I would pencil him in, especially post Matisse, because I think Matisse is going to play here. I would say I view Zaire as more of a mid to high teens guy, but there's a lot of moving parts here because there's still Vando, Adu, Cameron Carr. We don't know how those guys are going to factor in. Is Matisse potentially going to start? Then there's Jake. Like, I think a lot of these guys are at similar-ish levels. And I think with Zaire, his skill set, you mentioned the defense. Like, I actually think the defense is the reason why he'd be playing more so than even the offense, because he's not some lights-out shooter. He's a solid catch-and-shoot guy. But I think the primary thing would be the defense, the length, the defensive playmaking. Like, that's why I think he would be out there, the athleticism, the youth, etc. So I think Zaire, right now, if I had to put like an over under, it's probably 15 and a half in terms of minutes. And I'm not sure. Obviously, if he's starting, I think it's over. If he's not starting, there's just sort of a bench squeeze right now with all those bench wing / forwards that I think that's a pretty good line. I would say 15 and a half right now is somewhere, close to where I think he'll be.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around waiting for the track to dry is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Next one from Goated with the Riz. What do you think is the greatest Lakers team of all time? Now, this is a tough one, but I will give you my answer. The greatest Lakers team of all time, in my opinion, is the 2000-2001 Lakers, who went 15-1 en route to winning their second consecutive championship, what would ultimately become a three-peat. And the reason why, for me, playoff success is more important than regular season success. So already I'm starting out, like I'm only looking at Lakers teams that won the championship. And I think there are several teams that are, you know, belong in this conversation. First and foremost, the 1987 Lakers. I think that team belongs in this conversation, and to me would probably be my number two choice. My number three choice would probably be the 1972 Lakers. Remember, that was Jerry and Wilt. Elgin Baylor retired that season, early in the season. They have the 33-game win streak. They win it. And so that team is up there, you know, franchise record, 69 wins. The 2009 Lakers are also up there for me. The first year of them going back to back, that team won 65 games. I don't think it gets its just due from NBA fans, NBA media. And then I would throw in the 1985 Lakers as my number five team. But you could also go with the 1980 Lakers. You could go with the 2000 Lakers. You could probably give a honorable mention to the 2020 Lakers, but I would say my top five in order would probably be 2001, 1987, 1972, 2009, and then 1985. The reason why I go with the 2001 team, because remember, that team underachieved relatively in the regular season, went from winning 67 games in 2000 to 56 in 2001. But the dominance in the playoffs with that 15-1 performance, which up until the 2017 Warriors was the best playoff performance of all time. And they swept some heavy hitters. They swept the Blazers, who had just taken them to seven in the conference finals the season before. They swept the Kings, who would take them to seven in the following season. And they swept the Spurs, who had Tim Duncan, you know, entering his prime and had already won a championship. And, you know, they dominated that series. And then Allen Iverson gets game one in LA. It's an iconic game, an iconic moment, but the Lakers end up winning it in five. And the crazy thing with that 2001 team is they led the playoffs in both offensive rating and defensive rating. And that to me is just special, where these other teams, like the 87 team, was first in offense, fourth in defense. You'll see oftentimes a champion will lead in one category, but not necessarily both. That team was just special. And they're looking it up right now. Their net rating was a 13.7. That is an insane net rating. And really, like, you're thinking 96 Bulls, 2017 Warriors, and now, at least statistically, the 2026 Knicks, though I don't think they're on the level of any of those teams. But this, to me, is one of the best teams of all time. You have Kobe and Shaq at the peak of their powers. Let me read you the playoff numbers from those two. Absolutely insane. Shaq averaged 30 points, 15 rebounds, 6 offensive rebounds, 3 assists, 2.5 blocks, shot 55.5% on 21.5 field goal attempts per game. Kobe averaged 29, 7-6, a steal and a half, and nearly a block on 47% shooting on 22 attempts per game. Like, these two were monsters. That was one of the best performances we've seen from a duo in NBA history. Might be the peak duo we've seen in NBA history is 2001, Kobe and Shaq. I think Kobe is finally getting his flowers for how special he was, particularly in the Sacramento and San Antonio series that year. But, you know, Shaq, of course, was Shaq and won Finals MVP and was, I think, the best player in the world. And you know, should have been in stronger consideration for the 2001 MVP. But those two combined averaging nearly 60 points per game, averaging almost 23 rebounds per game, over 9 assists, 2 steals, over 3 blocks, and just being monsters. And like, that supporting cast, some of my favorite Lakers of all time: Derek Fisher, Rick Fox, Robert Horry, Brian Shaw, Ron Harper, Devin George, etc. Not like the craziest level of supporting cast, especially when you look at the supporting cast of some other teams and who they had as their third, fourth, fifth guys. So like, that team, I mean, those guys made, you know, they fit perfectly around Kobe and Shaq. They fit the triangle. They made big shots, of course, Horry first and foremost, in, you know, Fisher, and like, they played defense and they were the perfect supporting cast role players for that team. I just think Kobe and Shaq in 2001 were better than Magic and Kareem in 87 or 85, and better than West and Wilt in 72, better than Kobe and Powell in 2009, better than LeBron and AD in 2020. I just think that's the best duo we've ever seen in NBA history at the peak of their powers, and both at the peak of their powers. Like, you know, I mean, Kobe, I think eventually peaked, in my opinion, in 2006, though you could argue 2008 or 2009. He wins MVP in 2008, wins his fourth title, and starts that second back-to-back quest in 2009. But Shaq, I think, was right there with, like, you know, 2000 Shaq is prime Shaq. 2001, he was still pretty dominant. And so, yeah, those two as a 1-2 punch in the second year together, something about the sequel going back-to-back, that was just a really special team. And so, I mean, if you want to factor in the regular season more, or if you're weighting this 50-50, you probably put 1987 or 1972 ahead, and maybe 2001 drops to third. I think it's really a competition among those three. To me, 87 was the best of the Showtime teams, and 72 was the best pre-Showtime team, or at least post-Minneapolis team. But the Lakers have a ton of teams to pick between. I mean, again, like that 87 team, 65-17, had a plus nine net rating in the regular season. And then in the playoffs, only lost three games the entire postseason, and had the best offense, the fourth best defense. And looking at their net rating right here, plus 11.3 net rating. So that's why for me, 87 is right there as the number two team, and the team that you could argue. I just think Kareem was at a different stage of his career at that point. And I mean, you could argue that with Worthy was a beast that postseason. So you could argue that maybe the trifecta of those three outweighs Kobe and Shaq, but I just think Shaq would have dominated that defense, and Kobe would have been awesome. But of course, you know, Magic would have been great, Worthy, Kareem, et cetera. The 72 team went 12-3 in the playoffs. So they only had three rounds, not four. And in terms of net rating, they're actually at a plus 2.8. They had the third best of the eight teams that made the playoffs. It's crazy, only eight teams. So, like, this is all relative, right? But I would say, relatively, the 87 and 2001 teams were more dominant against their competition in the playoffs. Of course, the 72 team, 33 game win streak, 69-13. That team is unequivocally the best regular season Lakers team of all time with the overall record and the win streak. I would just say, when factoring in the playoffs, 87 and 2001, they had to play an extra round, and I think they fared better relatively against their competition. That, to me, I think those two teams are the two best teams in Lakers history. And again, if you're a Showtime person, you're going to lean 87. Maybe you are on the side of 85 or 80. I'm just going off of the number, like both playoff record and net rating in the playoffs. And that, to me, is weighted more so than regular season. But going, I mean, that team was dominant in the regular season and the playoffs. 2001 was more so in the playoffs, although 56-26 is nothing to scoff at. I would say 2001. 2001 to me is the best Laker team of all time. Final one from Kenneth the Geek. Yo-Yo Von, big fan from the Philippines. Question, who is your favorite Laker player of all time? Do you have one that is not an all-star player? And how important is starring their role in basketball? More power to you. Well, shout out to Kenneth and shout out to the Philippines. Appreciate you tuning in and appreciate the question. Favorite Laker player of all time is Shaquille O'Neal. And it's a relevant topic right now because of his recent comments about not being loved or embraced by the fan base and sort of relating to LeBron. I'm not going to go down that road. That's an entirely different conversation. But I became a Lakers fan in 2000 when I was eight. That's when I discovered basketball. And it just happened to coincide with the Lakers starting a three-peat and Shaq winning three finals MVPs, being a dominant player. I think the most dominant player, the best player in the league, obviously won 2000 MVP. And also at that time, I've always been tall for my grade. So I've always played center and I've always been like the tallest player out there up until high school when I started playing against like 7-footers and 6'10 guys. But up through like middle school, I was often the tallest guy out there. And so I always played at the five, and I even could relate to Shaq of like, I was so big that they started like Haka, Jovan, or just like hard fouling me when I would do like post ups or drop steps. So I really related to Shaq, and also the personality, being in movies and rapping and can you dig it? Like, just it was hard not to love that. So Shaq is my favorite Laker of all time. Do I have one that is not an all-star player? I mean, I love the supporting cast of that three-peat team. First name that comes to mind, I loved Rick Fox's game and the job that he did defensively against Peja Stojakovic in that 2001 series to bring back the 2001 Lakers. But just like, he fit that 3-and-D archetype of going out there, shooting threes, defending the best perimeter guy / wing guy, and just doing it at a high level. And so Rick Fox, I really like that archetype. Robert Horry, D-Fish, more so the first stretch of championships than the second one. The second one, he drove me crazy sometimes with the shot selection. But I would like that era of role players. With the second era of role players, Lamar is up there. Andrew Bynum's up there. He technically made an all-star team, but not up to that point. Sasha Vujacic, Jordan Farmar. I love the bench mob, Shannon Brown. So I would say probably overall, Lamar is my favorite Lakers non-all-star based on my fandom from 2000 to 2010 before I went to college and started covering the NBA at a professional level in 2011. But I would say Lamar and Rick Fox. Trevor Ariza is another one those three are probably my three favorite. Lamar, Rick Fox, Trevor Ariza, I would say. So I do have a type, like the rangy defensive wing. Hey, that's bringing it full circle. That's what the Lakers need to add. They need to add a Lamar or a Trevor Ariza or a Rick Fox to this team. And then I think they'll be in good shape. And yes, like, starring in your role is the key to basketball, especially for non-stars. If you're a star, you get to star. I mean, you need to star in your role, but you get to test out and take certain shots or do certain things. You have greater allowances as a star, though. It's also important to set the tone and set a precedent for how things, like, you need to conduct yourself. You need to lead the group. And based on your spot in the hierarchy, based on your contract, you have a ton of pressure, a ton of responsibility to lead and set an example. So that's important too. Like, of course, stars have to star in their role, but typically star in your role means you can do more, but you are doing less to fit what the team needs. And that is the key to any championship team. Look at every championship team. I implore you to find one that has their supporting cast, like, didn't star in their role, didn't do exactly what they needed, and didn't sacrifice and take a step back, do less than they're capable of, but did what the coaching staff asked, bought into the system, bought into the schemes, and maximized their role in that particular setting. So I 100% agree with you that starring their role is the most important thing. But that'll do it for today's show. Appreciate you guys for watching and listening. For those watching on YouTube, please be sure to hit that subscribe button, turn on channel notifications, and like and comment on this video. For those listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice, please be sure to follow, download, and leave a 5-star review. I'll be back later in the week. I'll talk to you then.